Hello, this is Jamie Peterson with the Herald and Review for Wednesday, February 26, 2020. We begin today's reading on the front page with the headline, Board Hears Concerns, by Annalisa Trofimik. A group of parents and former teachers is calling for Decatur School Board members to resign, saying hundreds had signed a petition of no confidence they gave the board Tuesday. Representatives of the group said the board has mishandled decisions about the spending of taxpayer dollars, the ongoing BOLD facilities plan, and student safety. They also criticized the district for failing to reach a contract agreement with Decatur teaching assistants, who have worked without a contract since August. The petition had 685 signatures, but does not legally require any action by the board, according to Kevin Collins Brown, a co-creator of the document. Board President Beth Nolan declined to comment after the meeting. There's been a demonstration of a total lack of understanding in what is necessary to safely educate our children, said Phil Schills, another parent who helped present the petition. There has repeatedly been a lack of responsiveness and disrespect to the countless community members who have voiced concerns, as is their right in this forum. As a board that takes pride in your 7-0 monolithic, completely unanimous voting record, the petition applies to all of you. The remarks were part of the public comments portion of Tuesday's board meeting, during which several parents also raised concerns about an incident involving a substitute teacher at Dennis Lab School on Friday. They said the teacher used force to prevent several children from leaving a classroom at the end of the day. Jacob Jenkins, Decatur resident and chairman of the Greater Decatur Black Chamber of Commerce, also spoke about the incident. I'm here today because I want everyone to know that black girls matter and their voices will not be silenced, he said. Jenkins said the students were taken out of class the following Monday to be questioned about the incident without proper supervision and that a teacher involved in the questioning is related to the substitute teacher. The children were being harassed and coerced to change their story, Jenkins said. These are classical tactics used in white schools that lack diversity and cultural competency. Although those who spoke named the adults who were involved, District Attorney Brian Braun encouraged them not to do so. I'm concerned about the rights of employees and the rights of kids who don't have an opportunity to defend themselves in this forum, Braun said. Speaking before the meeting, Chief Communications Officer Denise Swarthout acknowledged that the district is looking into the incident and said the substitute teacher had not returned to the school. She said administration is continuing to work with principals, students, and parents at the school to determine appropriate steps and restorative measures. Decatur Police Lieutenant Shannon Seal told the Herald and Review that a patrol officer was called to the school Friday afternoon after a complaint was received from a parent about the teacher's actions. But Seal said no action was taken after an investigation and a review of the video by both the officer and supervisors. It was determined the teacher did not batter anyone, Seal said. The lieutenant said police had received several complaints from parents about their decision but stood by it. A video circulating on social media shows portions of the incident where the teacher is seen pushing students back into the classroom as they try to exit. Police said they saw the video. There was no criminal offense and there was no evidence of any criminal offense, Seal said. Tuesday's meeting was filled with people wearing blue shirts in support of the Decatur Federation of Teaching Assistants. The union and district are set to meet for another mediation session Wednesday. The teaching assistants have been in contract negotiation sessions with the district since April and went on strike for 3 days in October. A federal mediator has been involved since August, and the two sides last met in January. Health insurance costs and compensation have been the two main sticking points in the talks. Teaching assistants say they cannot afford the proposed increases in the cost of insurance coverage, while the district says it is offering reasonable plans. We hope that when we come to the table after 6 weeks, that you're prepared with a proposal for us so we can settle this contract, said Union President Paula Busboom. Swarthout, after the meeting, said the district had no comment about the upcoming mediation session. The teaching assistants will host a rally at 3:30 p.m. Wednesday outside the Keel Building, 101 West Cerro Gordo Street. Several of those who spoke at the meeting said the room was not large enough to host the number of residents seeking to attend. Board meetings are sometimes hosted at schools such as Eisenhower or MacArthur High Schools to accommodate large crowds. Swarthout acknowledged that the district received a call before Tuesday's meeting seeking such a venue change. However, district staff felt there was nothing on the agenda that merited a site change, she said. Teaching assistants and community members filled all of the seats on the first floor meeting room in the Keel building. An additional 40 community members sat in a room upstairs to view the meeting on the district's live Facebook feed. Collins Brown said the board's decision not to move shows their lack of care for public concern. "I really don't think they expected participation or for people to be here," Collins Brown said. "They ignore any and all of our questions and requests." In other business, also on Tuesday, Theo Fisher and Simone Lee, two students involved in the Superintendent's Advisory Council, presented proposed additions to the district's dress code. The students said they did not want to change the current policy, but to add spirit wear to the dress code. The proposed addition would include allowing students to wear hoodies all week long so long as the hoods were down during the school day. Another idea within the plan included wearing t-shirts in place of a polo. "We just want the kids to feel more themselves at school," Fisher said. Board members expressed approval of the plan. Also on the front page, CDC, virus spread imminent. Wall Street plunges amid coronavirus impact concerns. Associated Press. U.S. health officials warned Tuesday that the burgeoning coronavirus is certain to spread more widely in the country at some point, even as their counterparts in Europe and Asia scramble to contain new outbreaks of the illness. "It's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness," Dr. Nancy Messonnier of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said in a call with reporters. The CDC's call for Americans to be prepared added a new urgency to response efforts that until this week focused on a disease largely confined to China, where it apparently originated, and neighboring countries. Stocks fell sharply again on Wall Street Tuesday, piling on losses a day after the market's biggest drop in 2 years, as fears spread that the growing virus outbreak will put the brakes on the global economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 879 points for a two-day loss of 1,911 points. Travel-related stocks took another drubbing, bringing the two-day loss for American Airlines to 16.9%. The large publicly traded cruise operators have also suffered double-digit losses. The worst-case scenario for investors, where the virus spreads around the world and cripples supply chains and the global economy, hasn't changed in the last few weeks. But the possibility of it happening has risen, says Yung-Yu Ma, chief investment strategist at BMO Wealth Management. Tuesday morning on Capitol Hill, senators of both political parties questioned whether the White House's request for $2.5 billion to combat the spread of the virus would be enough. "If you lowball something like this, you'll pay for it later," Senator Richard Shelby, Republican, Alabama, told Alex Azar, Trump's top health official. The two faced each other at a budget hearing that turned into a forum for assessing U.S. readiness. Shelby said if the virus keeps spreading, it could be an existential threat to a lot of people in this country. He chairs the powerful Appropriations Committee, which sets spending levels for federal agencies. Azar said that nearly 2 months after the first alarms were raised, there's no evidence that the virus has spread here beyond patients infected overseas and a few close relatives. Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington said the administration's handling of the crisis has been unacceptable. "We cannot afford to plan on the cheap or at the last minute," she said. "I'm deeply concerned that we are way behind the eight ball on this." In other developments Tuesday, new clusters of the illness popped up far from China, causing increased concern for officials in some of the wealthiest nations in Europe and Asia, as well as in countries with far fewer resources. But many remained uncertain about how best to contain it. The new outbreaks were reported in places as far-flung as Italy and Iran, France and Algeria, and Spain's Canary Islands. The tiny Persian Gulf nature of Bahrain said it had 17 cases, including a school bus driver who transported students as recently as Sunday. In Iran, the head of the country's virus task force, who just a day earlier urged the public not to overreact about the spread of the disease, tested positive. The official, Iraj Harichi, posted a new video online promising authorities would bring the virus under control within weeks. But a ministry spokesman, Kanoush Janapour, said it could take at least until the Persian New Year's holiday of March 20, or as long as late April, to contain the disease. "We don't expect a miracle in the short term," he said. Officials in South Korea said they were racing to contain an outbreak that has grown to nearly 1,000 cases. "It's a matter of speed and time. We must create a clear turning point within this week," President Moon Jae-in said. In the largest cluster in the city of Daegu and nearby towns, many shops remained closed Tuesday, and activity in some neighborhoods came to a near standstill. The virus's toll continued to mount, even as Chinese officials reported a slowing in the number of new cases. As of Tuesday, the spread of the illness sickened some 80,000 people worldwide and caused about 2,700 deaths. The vast majority of those infections remain in China, where 518 new cases were reported Tuesday and another 71 deaths, 68 of them in the central city of Wuhan, where the epidemic was first detected in December. The updates bring mainland China's totals to 77,780 cases and 2,666 deaths, according to the World Health Organization. Also on the front page, out of Springfield, lawmakers seek drug price caps. By Peter Hancock, Capital News, Illinois. New board would set upper payment limits on high-cost meds. A group of Democratic lawmakers renewed their push Tuesday for a bill that would pave the way for price caps on many high-cost prescription drugs, a proposal that is likely to meet strong resistance from the pharmaceutical industry. Representative Will Guzzardi of Chicago and Senator Andy Menar of Bunker Hill said the rising cost of prescription drugs has gotten out of control, putting the health of many Illinoisans at risk. "This is a staggering problem, and it's happening across the country," Guzzardi said during a news conference at the Capitol. "Drug manufacturers are making record profits quarter after quarter, year after year, while our families are struggling to afford the medications that they need." Guzzardi is the chief sponsor of House Bill 3493, a measure he introduced last year. It would establish a 5-member prescription drug affordability board that would have authority to conduct cost reviews and set upper payment limits for any brand name drug with a wholesale price of $30,000 or more for a 1-year supply or a course of treatment, or for any drug for which the wholesale price jumps by $3,000 or more in a single year. Upper payment limits are commonly used in private insurance and state Medicaid programs, but they are typically negotiated individually between the health plan and drug manufacturers. Guzzardi said his bill would establish uniform upper payment limits that would apply to all payers statewide. That same authority would extend to biosimilar drugs, a biologic product that is highly similar to another drug already approved for sale with a price that is less than 15% below the name brand price. It would also have authority to regulate generic drug prices if those drugs cost $100 or more for a 30-day supply, or if their prices jump 200% or more in a single year. Maynor, who's sponsoring the bill in the Senate, called it a reasonable step in the right direction that will say to all of the purveyors of profit in today's healthcare system, when it comes to the affordability of prescription medication, you're going to have to cut it out. Also speaking at the news conference was Graciela Guzman, a woman who suffers from endometriosis and is a campaign director at the Healthy Illinois Campaign Public Policy Group. She said the cost of one of her medications recently jumped from $68 to $500. Because of that, she said, she chose to split her pills in half in order to stretch out her supply, but that also meant she wasn't well enough to go about her normal daily routine. "Medications can't work for me if I can't afford them, period," she said. "I know I'm not alone in that. So many Illinoisans across the state need the peace of mind to know their prescriptions are going to be there for them and that they will be able to afford them." Guzzardi introduced the bill last year, but it stalled in a House committee after it failed to win a majority of votes to advance to the House floor. At that time, the bill drew opposition from the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association, or PhRMA, a group that represents the biopharmaceutical industry. It was also opposed by the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and a host of other business groups. This year, Guzzardi said he is proposing some minor changes based on the feedback he heard from the committee and other interest groups. Tiffany Haverly, Director of Public Affairs at PhRMA, issued an email statement saying the group is sympathetic toward those who struggle to afford their medications. With that said, proposals like HB 3493 that arbitrarily set prices are the wrong approach and could limit Illinoisans' access to treatments and cures, she said. Further, HB 3493 fails to address the long line of middlemen in the pharmaceutical supply chain that impact what patients pay at the pharmacy counter. One of the best ways to lower out-of-pocket costs is to make sure patients get their share of the rebates and discounts that biopharmaceutical companies already provide. Rebates and discounts that exceeded $166 billion in 2018 alone, the statement continued. At the end of the day, the government price setting proposed in this legislation could threaten further research into life-saving medicines and put patients' access at risk. The bill is still pending in the House Prescription Drug Affordability and Accessibility Committee, which Guzzardi chairs. It was scheduled for a hearing this week, but the committee was canceled and is expected to be rescheduled. Finally, on the front page of the paper, Coffee with the Newsroom event today by the Herald and Review. Members of the Herald and Review newsroom will be meeting with readers today at Wildflower Artisan Bakery and Cafe, 256 West Main Street. Our latest Coffee with the Newsroom is noon to 1 p.m. Newsroom staff will be there to connect with readers and spend time catching up on issues in the community, including what needs more local coverage. They'll also talk about the work they do. Our newsroom staff loves connecting with the community, said Allison Petty, the Herald and Review's local news editor. Those ideas turn into our stories, and we're always looking for those. On to page 3, Man Flashes Store Worker, Police Say, by Tony Reed. A man trying on clothes at a Forsyth store is accused of exposing himself to a female associate, and when he was arrested later, was found to have stolen the outfit he was trying on, police said. A sworn affidavit from the Macon County Sheriff's Office describes the 28-year-old man standing in the men's section of Von Maur at the Hickory Point Mall at 5:15 Monday, looking at clothes. He selected a pair of jeans, a blue hoodie, and a brown belt to try on and headed for the dressing rooms. He then asked the female associate to come over and give him an opinion on how the clothes look. He spun around to show the female his outfit, said Macon County Sheriff's Deputy Joseph Herbert, writing in the affidavit. He stopped, faced the female, and then suddenly pulled his pants down, exposing his genitals to her. The female associate stated she was alarmed and disturbed by his actions and quickly hurried away from the dressing room. The man was described as immediately leaving after the incident, but police tracked him down a short time later and surprised him at the nearby Texas Roadhouse restaurant where he was eating dinner. The female associate came to the restaurant and positively identified the man, Herbert added. While patting him down, I discovered he was wearing the Von Maur jeans underneath his other jeans. He was also wearing the blue hoodie and had the brown belt on. Herbert said the man admitted to stealing the clothing items while on the squad car ride to the Macon County Jail. He was booked on preliminary charges of public indecency, disorderly conduct, and retail theft. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the state attorney's office. A check of Macon County jail records showed the man remained in custody Tuesday night in lieu of making bail set at $15,000, which means he must post $1,500 to be released. Out of Bloomington, Pritzker, only one budget. Schools to get hike in funding even if fair tax amendment fails, by Lenore Sabota. Governor J.B. Pritzker denied on Tuesday that he is presenting two budgets, one based on passage of the Progressive or Fair Tax Amendment by voters this fall, and one passed on that proposed constitutional amendment being rejected. There's only one budget, he said in a meeting with a joint editorial board of the Pantograph, Indicator, Herald, and Review. It has a reserve that won't be spent if fair tax doesn't pass. You have to have a balanced budget. Even without passage of the amendment, which would allow the state to raise more revenue, all school districts would get an increase in funding, he said. If the amendment is approved, $350 million more than last year would go to school funding using the evidence-based formula, he said. If it is rejected, schools would still get $200 million more using a formula that allocates money based on need. District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley has said previously that as a Tier 2 district, the larger figure would result in an additional $200,000 for District 87. Asked how the uncertainty about funding would affect the ability of districts to plan, Pritzker said, "We'll know four and a quarter months into the fiscal year whether the amendment passes." When the difference of $150 million is divided among the state's many school districts, the amount in question turns out to be important, but not determinative, he said. Increased funding for K-12 education is important not only because Illinois ranks last in the nation when it comes to state funding for schools, said Pritzker, but also because of the impact that it has on property taxes. The governor said property taxes have gone up because the state is slowly reducing its share of funding for schools. Pritzker cited two other areas placing pressure on property taxes, infrastructure and pensions for police and firefighters. He noted that the current budget provides $650 million to local governments for infrastructure projects and said another measure he helped pass, which consolidated police and fire pension funds so they can be invested more wisely, will result in a better return that will alleviate pressure for higher taxes. As for the state-level pension problems, Pritzker said, we need to be sure we aren't skipping payments, as has happened in the past. In regard to the recent commutation of the sentence of former Governor Rod Blagojevich and how that brought back talk of Pritzker's conversations with Blagojevich that were caught on an FBI wiretap, Pritzker said, I think we've talked already too much about Governor Blagojevich. We need to move on. He said what was disturbing to him was very little of the ethics reforms approved after Blagojevich's impeachment dealt with legislators' activities, and that's where we're seeing problems today. Pritzker said the state should stop the revolving door of lawmakers leaving office and going to work for companies for whom they supported legislation while in the General Assembly. He also said elected officials should not be allowed to be paid lobbyists, even if they are lobbying another branch of government. Assumption made about EIU swimmer. Charleston by Dave Fope. Governor J.B. Pritzker said Tuesday that an assumption about a black Eastern Illinois University swimmer led to his being held at gunpoint by police. It seems clear to me that an assumption was made about this EIU swimmer who was doing nothing but minding his own business, as I understand it, he said. That's the kind of behavior we want to make sure we ferret out and root out of all of our police departments. Pritzker referenced the February 24, 2019 incident in the Quad Cities that resulted in a federal lawsuit being filed by Jalen Butler during a meeting with the joint editorial board, the Pantograph, Indicator, Herald, and Review. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit on Butler's behalf last month, accusing the officers of wrongful arrest and detention and threatening to shoot Butler, then 19. The suit claims a gun was pointed at Butler's head while traveling with the EIU swim team, while the team's bus was stopped at a rest stop along Interstate 80. Pritzker noted that investigations into the incident are taking place and the reported circumstances of the incident make those justified. The governor's comments came about a week after EIU officials expressed support for Butler, with University President David Glassman saying the incident stirred outrage, as it should. EIU's support has been multidimensional in assisting Jalen and his teammates with the emotional understanding and healing needed from experiencing such a traumatic event, Glassman said last week. Although EIU's support for Jalen has occurred mostly outside the public eye and likely will stay that way, I want the university community to know EIU's steadfast support for Jalen will continue throughout his journey, Glassman also said. According to the lawsuit, the swim team bus had stopped and Butler was the last to get back on after he took a selfie to post to the college's social media platforms. As he walked back to the bus, which also had EIU's logo on the signs, police vehicles from several local jurisdictions rushed into the rest area, the suit says. The lawsuit claims police forced Butler face down in the snow and held him there. Two officers pointed guns at him, with one saying, "If you move, I'll blow your expletive head off," according to the lawsuit. The police were looking for an at-large fugitive, but that man's only similarity to Butler was that they're both black, the lawsuit claims. The lawsuit was filed on January 21. Case records indicate there are no hearings scheduled, but deadlines are in place next month for attorney responses to requests for evidence and records exchanges. Also out of Springfield by Peter Hancock. Reform advocates rally to end cash bail. Criminal justice reform advocates rallied Tuesday at the State House in hopes of making Illinois one of only a handful of states to eliminate cash bail in all or most criminal cases. "It's unconscionable that there are people locked up in our jails simply because they don't have enough money to pay their bonds," said Malik Alim, campaign coordinator for the Coalition to End Money Bond. "That is what we want to do away with. We want to do away with the money bond system." The idea of abolishing cash bonds has been gaining traction in the State House, and this year Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker endorsed it during his State of State speech in January as part of a broader criminal justice reform initiative. New Jersey passed a law to eliminate cash bail, which went into effect in 2017. Under that system, arrestees are assessed on a point system to determine if they should be released from custody, held in jail pending trial, or released under restrictions such as house arrest. Alaska and New York have since adopted similar reforms. California also has passed similar legislation, but it is subject to a veto referendum that will be on the November general election ballot. Illinois did pass a bail reform law in 2017 that allows most people charged with nonviolent crimes to be released without posting cash bail, but a number of lawmakers have been calling for the complete elimination of cash bail. But the idea has also met with some resistance, especially from prosecutors and law enforcement agencies who argue that cash bail helps ensure a defendant will show up at trial. They also argue that it provides a source of funds to help compensate crime victims. From Decatur by Garrett Karsten. Affidavit, search yields drugs, gun. Police say cocaine and a firearm were found at the residence of a Decatur man convicted of previous felony charges in Macon County. A sworn affidavit said police executed a search warrant Monday night in a residence in the 300 block of West Leafland Avenue. Police say members of the emergency response team assisted in the search. The suspect, a 50-year-old man, was found inside along with roughly half a gram of a substance that tested positive as cocaine and digital scales, police said. According to the affidavit, the suspect told police he lived there and sold crack from the residence, but they had no knowledge of the firearm in the residence. He told police he had given drugs to a woman who had been at the residence that day, the affidavit said. Detectives found a handgun in a box in the bedroom with a document in the name of suspect under the handgun, according to sworn affidavit. The suspect was arrested on preliminary charges of unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon and manufacturing delivering cocaine less than a gram. He was booked into Macon County Jail on Tuesday morning and is being held on a bail amount of $100,000, meaning he must post $10,000 for release. Also in local news, woman says car disabled, by Tony Reed. A Decatur man, unhappy that his girlfriend of 2 years had broken up with him, got his revenge by sabotaging her car, police said. The 38-year-old man is accused of lacing the vehicle's fuel tank with a mixture of sugar and water, which caused the engine to stall when she tried to drive, according to a sworn affidavit from Decatur police. The incident is said to have happened in the early morning of August 14, and the affidavit said police found and arrested the man Monday morning. Police officer Jason Hesse said he interviewed the 40-year-old victim at the time, and she had said the man was not taking the breakup well. He had made threats to damage her car and specifically talked of pouring sugar into the gas tank. She told Hesse she had been staying overnight at a friend's home in the 1700 block of East North Street when a noise woke her at 5 a.m., and she went outside for a look. Hesse said she described seeing a man near her car, as he fled, he passed under a streetlight, and she recognized him as her ex-boyfriend. Hesse quoted the woman as saying she didn't think much of the incident and started her car up at 7 a.m. and drove off. She stated as she began to travel westbound on East El Dorado Street, her vehicle died. Hesse added. She has stated she believed she had a quarter tank of gas when she parked her vehicle the night before. Late after the car was towed to the garage, a mechanic told Hesse he had dropped the gas tank and found it filled with straight brown water that was mixed with what he believed was brown sugar. Flushing the fuel lines and other engine repairs were likely to result in a repair bill well over $1,000, the mechanic said. The ex-boyfriend was booked on a preliminary charge of tampering with a vehicle. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the state attorney's office. He remained held in Macon County Jail on Tuesday in lieu of a bond set at $20,000, which means he must post $2,000 to be released. Dobson leaving WAND. WAND-TV's Jessica Dobson is leaving the station to become a meteorologist in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Central Illinois has been so welcoming since I first called this place home over 2 years ago, she said on Facebook. I've met a number of amazing people, both in and outside of work. Many of my coworkers at WAND have become my best friends and mentors during this time. She previously was with WNKY-TV in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Dobson is a Louisville, Kentucky native and graduate of Western Kentucky University. Her last day is March 5. Residents cope amid outage. Out of Mattoon, by Rob Stroud. A power outage hit much of Mattoon's central business corridor from Interstate 57 to the downtown early Tuesday afternoon. Traffic signals were darkened on Illinois 16 Charleston Avenue between Swords Drive and 9th Street and on downtown Broadway Avenue between 14th and 16th Streets from approximately 12:30 to when Ameren Illinois restored power at 1:30 p.m. Ameren Illinois spokeswoman Marcella Love said the outage was caused by an equipment failure in a substation on the east side of Mattoon. She said the outage knocked out power to approximately 1,800 of the utility company's customers. The affected customers included several restaurants and stores during the lunch hour. At the Cross County Mall, stores temporarily closed while some customers continued walking laps to the dimly illuminated main concourse of the building for exercise. Don Sol Mexican Grill owner Amanda Perdomo said her restaurant, 230 Broadway East, had to briefly stop admitting customers while the power was out because it could not cook food at the time, while already seated customers were able to finish their meals. Perdomo said Del Sol also was preparing to cater a lunch at the mall when the outage started. She said the lunch was able to continue because each of the food containers had a flame unit with it. She said mall property owner Roll King brought in portable lights from its store there to illuminate the buffet line. St. John's Lutheran School principal Trent Dunkett said the outage affected both of the school's buildings on its campus at Broadway and 2nd Street. The teachers adapted and kept things going, Dunkett said. Students read by light from the windows and from their laptops for their lessons, and they played games in their classrooms for recess instead of going to the gymnasium, he said. Duckett said Ameren had initially notified customers that the outage might continue until as late as 3 p.m., so he and his staff were preparing for a full afternoon without power. He said they were relieved when the lights came on much earlier. Ameren did a great job of restoring the power, Duckett said. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review. Please stay tuned.